G'day, wherever you may be around the world. Thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2lidiu.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, my friend.
Hey, Jono, how are you?
Doing pretty well. Thank you, mate. Good to have you back on the program because where are we at? Job chapter 21, is that where we are?
21. How was 21? Sydney?
How was Sydney? Oh.
Oh.
Sydney, you know what? I love living in the country. Man, do I love living in the country. Do you know the country town where we live has two traffic lights, two sets of traffic lights? When we were in Cootamundra, which is not far from here, there was no traffic lights. But in Sydney, it is so congested. It's just so crowded. I don't understand how... I mean, I grew up there the first, 30-something years of my life, but I just don't understand how people live there. I will never go back to live.
I know, but that's why I brought it up, because I figured this would get you in a mood for Job and suffering.
Yeah. It was suffering in many ways. But at the same time, you know, I caught up with Rabbi Eli Cohen on the previous Monday during Hanukkah, and observed they had an event, you know, the lighting of the Hanukkiah. I'm going to be talking about that with him at some stage soon. Will be an interesting conversation, I do think, in regards to how it relates to the oral law. But so that was interesting, and it was good to catch up with him. Crazy time for him, of course. He's absolutely flat out. But we will be recording probably I'd say we'll be doing that program in January. So listeners can wait for that one. Rabbi Eli Cohen of Jews for Judaism Australia. But we are doing Job chapter 21, and this is a really, really interesting chapter, Ira. And there are a couple of verses that I do want to center in on, and I'll let you know when we get there. But it begins like this. It says, now this is, of course, after Zophar's, you know, weigh-in for the second time. And as you pointed out last time we spoke, that was the last chapter 20, is the last time we hear from Zophar. But this is Job's response. And in my New King James Bible, Ira, it has a little subheading called Job's Discourse on the Wicked. It's very interesting. It begins like this, and I like the way it begins. Job basically says, you guys, shut up. Can you listen to the words of my mouth? Can you read my lips? It's just, listen to what I'm actually saying. He says, listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your consolation. Bear with me that I may speak, and after I've spoken, after you've listened to what I'm actually saying, after you consider and comprehend the words of my mouth, then you can keep mocking. Is that what he's basically saying? Is that the way he starts?
Actually, that's exactly the way it starts. And the way we know that is from the fact that we have the first two words in the Hebrew in chapter verse 2 is Shemu Shamoa. And this is where we have a situation where we have the imperative and the infinitive absolute. And anytime we see that in Hebrew, it's there for emphasis. I'm sure you've talked about instances where you've seen like mot yumat, where it'll say you will surely die. Mm-hmm. You see that often. And so when we see this kind of situation, it's exactly what you're saying. The reason why we see that emphasis is there because he's saying that. He's saying, look, basically, you guys have not been listening to anything that I've said so far. So listen carefully. Okay. He's saying it in kind of like a mocking kind of way, like listen carefully.
You're not comprehending what I'm saying.
Well, listen carefully, and you're not even listening. It's like you're just, all you're doing is waiting for me to be done so you can bring your ridiculous arguments, is what he's saying. And he's really getting frustrated here. He's really showing the frustration of someone who believes that nobody's having any patience with him. And he's basically saying, look, I already know, I'm already setting myself up, because I know that as soon as I get done, the only thing that I'm going to get from you guys is jeering and derision.
Yeah.
One more thing.
Sure.
Before I forgot, I forgot to mention this, is that what's interesting is in verse 3, the last word that we see there, which is that idea of deriding him, is in the singular, talig. And so basically, it almost appears that he's speaking to them in the same way that we saw that it appeared that Zophar was speaking individually in the last speech rather than on behalf of the group, mm-hmm. that it, at least here it begins to seem like he's speaking to them each individually rather than just as a group.
Oh, truly.
Yeah. Okay.
So from that, would we conclude that he perhaps is directing his response to Zophar in particular?
It's possible because it's in the singular, but it's not. It hasn't been only Zophar that answered as it relates to the wicked, and we'll see that as we go along. That you know, I'll reference some of the times that Eliphaz as well has come in and made reference to having a difference of opinion as to the, how God deals with the wicked.
True, and there's a number of those examples. So it goes on to say, as for me, is my complaint against man? And if it were, why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am terrified, and trembling takes hold of my flesh.
I think he's making the point that when he discusses this idea of is my complaint to man and why should I not, actually it says, why should my spirit not become impatient? He's talking about the fact that he could overcome a man's complaint, or he would be able to overcome if it was just man that was oppressing him. But this is from God, and mm-hmm. and it's kind of a plea in verse 5. Actually, I have in parentheses, I wrote down where it says, I have turned toward me and be appalled and put your hand over your mouth. It actually has this idea of turn your head in a certain direction. That's what the verb means. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like a plea almost of him asking for them to be involved personally, where I talked about before this lack of patience. It's almost like he wants them to be more invested personally in a suffering that's going on rather than just rebuking him for his theology.
Mm-hmm. And so as I said, the next from verse 7 to verse 16, Ira, let me just read through this and then we'll revisit it, because it really belongs all together. And as you mentioned, he responds to a number of comments by his so-called friends. He says, why do the wicked live and become old? Yes, become mighty in power. Their descendants are established with them in their sights, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon them. Their bull breeds without failure. Their cow calves without miscarriage. They send forth their little ones like a flock. And their children dance. They sing to the tambourine, the harp, and rejoice to the sound of the flute. They spend their days in wealth, and in a moment go down to the grave. They go down to Sheol. Yet they say to God, this is what they say to God, this is the wicked that we're talking about. They say to God, depart from us, for we do not desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we have if we pray to him? Indeed, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me.
Sure, that's some completely different perspective from Job compared to what we've heard from his friends.
So what his friends are basically saying is, look at you. Clearly, this is the hand of God upon you because you are wicked. Why do we know you're wicked? Well, look at you. You know,
right. Well, but they've also made the argument throughout. They gave an argument, Zophar did and Eliphaz did in Job 15, about what is prepared for the wicked. And mm-hmm. remember, we've made the argument several times through several chapters that at this point what Job is doing is he's arguing against divine providence. And he's saying that just the opposite happens. You're saying that these, you know, all these things are going to happen to the wicked, and if it doesn't happen now, it's going to happen to their children. And I'm seeing just the opposite of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And so he says, as you said, very similar translations to what I have. Why do they, the wicked, live? They move on also. They are strong in wealth. And really what he's talking about, they see old age here and they accomplish mighty things. Their seed is established with them before their face and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are secure from dread, fear, and the rod of Elohah is not upon them. And this would seem, that verse in verse 9 where it says their houses are secure from dread or fear and the rod of God or the rod of Elohah is not upon them, it would seem to me that this is an answer to Eliphaz and the assertions that he made in Job chapter 15. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Job chapter 15, verse 20 through 24, we read, the wicked rides in agony, torment all his days, and few years are reserved for the ruthless. Mm. A voice of dread is in his ears, and peace devastation comes. He does not trust that he will return from darkness, and he is destined for the sword. He wanders about for bread, saying, "Where is it?" That prepared in his hand is the day of darkness. Mm-hmm. Stress and anxiety terrify him like a king ready for the siege or the onslaught. So that's what Eliphaz says to him in chapter 15. And yet he's saying, wait a minute, you know, you're saying all this stuff, but here's Job saying that houses are secure from fear and the rod of God is not upon them.
And so while it may be the case, while he may have observed such, it's not always the case. It can't be guaranteed. And Job is saying, I've seen the wicked that are secure in their houses and that prosper.
Sure, they're prospering. And we see that today. I mean, look, that's one of the biggest complaints that you see of people of faith, whatever their faith is. You know, often you'll see people of faith ask the question, why is it that I'm suffering? Why is it that I can't find a job? Why is it I can't keep a job? Why is it that I can't pay my bills? And yet I see all these wicked people that don't believe in God. Mm. You know, they're out there driving the Mercedes and the, you know, the Land Rovers and the Hummers and things like that. It's the same question, you know, for the ages. And this is why Job is such a powerful work for us to answer some of these questions. Mm. In verse 10, his ox produces and does not fail. Actually, the verb there is talking about impregnating. So it's talking about the fact that even in this impregnating, it doesn't fail. Like every time his bulls mount, you know, they not only do the cows deliver and don't miscarry, but this guy never misses that bull, you know. Mm. And this also could be related back to Eliphaz's words, because in verse 33 of that chapter, in chapter 15, Eliphaz says he will throw off his unripe grape like the vine and will cast off his flower like the olive tree, which is kind of a metaphor for what we're talking about here.
Jeremiah, of course, Jeremiah's favorite, famous question, chapter 12, verses 1 to 4. Can I just quickly read through that?
Sure, absolutely.
Righteous are you, O Yehovah, when I plead with you, yet let me talk with you about your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? You have planted them. Yes, they have taken root. They grow. Yes, they bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. But you, O Yehovah, know me. You have seen me, and you have tested my heart towards you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter, and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long will the land mourn, and the herbs of every field wither? The beasts and the birds are consumed, and the wickedness of those who dwell there, because they say, he will not see our final end.
Yeah, that's very powerful. Did you say herb, by the way?
I said herb. Herb, yeah.
You know, you have me doing that all the time now.
That's what you're meant to do. You're meant to have an
I can't say herbs. I can't say herbs anymore.
I don't understand why you would say herb in the first place.
Because Lori makes us that special tea when we're not feeling it well.
The special herb tea.
And I have to say, honey, will you make that tea with the herbs?
Just as well, because otherwise how would she know what you're talking about?
I don't want Jono to hear me saying herb.
That's what it says.
Hey, look, but, help the fact that we English speakers really don't speak English. I'm from Brooklyn, pal. You're lucky I'm not going, hey, how you doing? So let's talk about the book of Job today. Where are we at? Chapter 21. Okay, let's see.
So this is the same question that Jeremiah has observed the same thing, that the wicked do prosper, that they're happy. Those who deal treacherously, they live happy lives.
Sure.
You know? And it's, you know, why? But this is merely what Job is pointing out. It's not always the case that things fall apart. But Ira, I'm going to go back to Deuteronomy a little later as well, but if we go to Deuteronomy and we go to, you know, I don't know what, verse chapter 28, and it talks about the curses. You know, we've got the blessings and the curses. And right. Among the curses, it says in verse 28, cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land and the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are in Job, and it says their bull breeds without failure, their cow calves without miscarriage, they send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance.
Right. Well, we are talking about a different time as well, you know. I mean, you know, the, of course, this is Deuteronomy 28 is coming on the heels of, you know, deliverance from Mitzrayim, and, you know, the Torah has been given and so forth. They're getting ready to enter into the land. And so there's, you know, there's these prohibitions that are given for wickedness. I mean, we know that the Eov of the book of Job is, you know, dates, you know.
Probably around the time of Abraham.
Yeah, but, sure, way before that. So,
but
so
Jeremiah, I'm not saying that Jeremiah's after, I mean, some years after that again. So it can be cause for confusion. I mean, how do you comprehend this?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily confusion. I think that this is a legitimate question that people have as it relates to the divine providence of God. You know, certainly somebody is going to look at the book of Job, and after looking at the, you know, the first two chapters of Job and seeing Job being called an Ishtam, a righteous man, you know, being confused as to how God would allow what's happening to him. And of course, it's silly for us to talk about that so far forward, because we're going to hear the reason for it, you know, in the later chapters when we get towards the end of the book. You know, we also know that you would believe that if you had been 400 years in captivity and slavery, and this benevolent God comes and not only delivers you but takes you out into the desert and provides for you, and your clothes don't wear out and you have food and water and so forth, that at some point you're going to listen to what he says and follow his instructions. And that didn't take place for very long. So we would assume that that would have happened. So it really is not unusual to see later on in the prophetic that the prophet who really lives, certainly not necessarily suffering the way Job did, but certainly it's not a pleasant job to have, to be called out by God to bring sin to the forefront of the people who don't want to hear about it. And we'll see a verse related to that in this chapter as well, as we get later in the chapter, chapter 21, because there's reference made to, you know, if you said this to the wicked person, they would just laugh at you if you rebuked them in this way. And that's basically what happened when the prophets rebuked. So the prophet is sitting there saying to himself, you know, why are you not, why are you allowing the wicked to prosper? Why are you allowing this to happen, you know, when you've basically called me and told me to, you know, to go to them and to tell them to repent? And it's all part of God's timing and God's divine providence. So that would be my answer.
And so it goes on to say, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out? How often does their destruction come upon them? The sorrows of God distributes in his anger. What's that? The sorrows of God distributes in his anger. They are like straw before the wind, like chaff that a storm carries away.
All right. Well, wait a minute. You took me too far ahead. You didn't let me speak about some of the other verses there.
Let's go back.
So anyway, no, I was just going to just make a couple of comments about this, because right after we get to the idea of this, you know, the cattle calving and, you know, no failure there, then we have a reference to the offspring of the wicked. And I think that I'm only making this reference because I think it's important to note that in the previous arguments so far, and Eliphaz were making the argument that even if we didn't see the wicked punished, that it would that the offspring would be punished as well. And so that's why it's important in verse 11 to see that he says that they also send forth their like a flock, their little ones and their children dance, and they lift up, you know, their voices, is what it's really saying there. They lift up their voices like the timbrel and the harp, and they rejoice to the voice of the flute. They wear out their days in the good, and in a moment they descend to Sheol, meaning that they enjoy the fullness of their days, and they go down in tranquility, not suffering the way I'm suffering.
No, in a full life, but rather, and then their full life is ended. They go to Sheol. It's not like this slow, painful,
like
lingering.
It's like they go to sleep one night and they don't wake up. To how anybody would want to go.
And so
these next two verses can point back to. In the next two verses, in verses 14 and 15, we kind of see him pointing back to verse 7, where he speaks about the prosperity of the wicked in contrast to their lack of looking towards the Creator. Because then he says, like you said, they say to God, turn aside from us, and in the knowledge of your ways we do not delight. What is Shaddai, or who is Shaddai that we should serve him, and what will we profit when we encounter him? And this is in sharp contrast to somebody like Job, who's called righteous. And what does Job say? Though he slay me.
Mm.
He's showing the difference in the contrast between him and the person who does that.
Mm.
And then, of course, as you said, going on, behold, their goodness is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. And I think that's interesting, because I think what he's doing here is he's claiming the opposite of what so far ended his speech with. If we remember in 2029, mm-hmm. Sofer says, this is the portion of a wicked man from Elohim, the possession intended from God. And if we read those verses before, you know, there's some suffering that Sofer talks about that these wicked are going to go through. And Job is saying, well, wait a minute, that sounds completely different than what I'm seeing. In other words, in other words, he's saying that somehow heaven is allowing the wicked to prosper, but I won't buy into that.
Mm.
And then, like verse 17, like, what is the lamp of the wicked, or how seldom is the lamp of the wicked put out, or has calamity come upon him? Does he divide destruction in his anger? And I think when he says, does he's talking about God here, because he's talking about, you know, the idea of the lamp being put out. In other words, does he give them their share of destruction? Is he giving them their share of punishment?
Mm-hmm.
He's making this argument that they certainly should be punished in a much greater manner than they're being punished. Let them be like straw before the wind and like chaff which is stolen by a storm.
Mm.
And then it says, Eloah hides disaster for his sons. In verse 19, let it be complete to him, or it could be let Eloah repay him so that he may know it.
So these,
this is what he's saying, what God should actually be doing.
These are the three verses, 19, 20, 21, that I really want to focus in on. Before I do that, of course, the whole, I would suggest to the listeners, when you get a chance, also read Psalm 37, because David talks about the righteous as opposed to the calamity of the wicked. But hey, let me read verse 1 and 2 just for you, Ira. It says, Psalm 37, do not fret because of evildoers. Do not be envious of the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. The green herb. Okay. So this is what I've got in mind, Ira. This is what it says in mind. Job 21, verses 19, 20, and 21. It says, they say, now before I continue, that's in italics. It says, they say, so as if Job is quoting. Is there something in the Hebrew that would suggest that this is a quote? Because it says in 19, in my version, in italics, they say, and then it says in normal text, God lays up one's iniquity for his children. Is there a reason why Job might be quoting a common saying, perhaps?
All right, so actually, it doesn't say that, okay? I even have, so let me look. In the JPS translation, in brackets, at the beginning of the verse, it says, you say. And that's in brackets, which tells you that it's not part of the text. But even those who translate the JPS are trying to say that this implies that he's speaking to somebody. But it doesn't say they, it says you.
Have they said specifically, have any of his so-called friends said this?
Are you going with the idea that, you know, the sins of the father are transferred to the third and fourth generation or something like that?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that. So the point that I make is that in italics, because these words aren't there, it begins by saying, they say. So who is the they? Maybe it was a saying, and it's interesting because we're going to look at this in just a moment, but in Ezekiel chapter 18, of course, Yehovah says to Ezekiel, he says, come on, what do you mean when you use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge? So the father does something and the children reap the repercussions of their actions. What is with that proverb what is with that saying that you guys have? Maybe there was a similar saying in the day that Job is referring to when the implication of they say is
I think the reason there. I think the reason why they insert it there, you say or they say, is because up until this point he's telling them what he thinks should happen to the wicked, and now we're seeing a transition where he's saying, you guys are saying
So the interesting thing, though,
you're saying that God hides disaster for his sons, but I'm saying let it be to him that God repays him so that he may know that he's wicked. That's what's happening in verse 19. That's why they're saying you say or they say.
But,
because really what it says is Elohim hides disaster for his son, let it be complete to him so that he may know it, or so that he may know.
So, okay, so my point is this, Ira, verse 19, they say is not in the text. What if it just simply reads like this? From 18, it says, they're like straw before the wind, and the chaff carries, the chaff that a storm carries away. God lays up one's iniquity for his children. Let him recompense him that he may know it. What if this is just that Job is stating this as he believes it to be a fact? Is it a possibility?
Well, what is he stating? What is he stating?
Well, that becomes the question. What is he stating? Where is he quoting from? Or what is the idea behind it that it may be truth? And it's interesting because my New King James Study Bible, Ira, it seems to play both sides of the coin. If I go down to the cross references, right, in my study Bible here, it will take me to, as you mentioned, Exodus chapter 20, verse 5, which is, of course, the Ten Commandments in reference to the second, which says, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, Yehovah, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, verse 6, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments.
Right.
Is that the perspective that we're taking here? Is this what Job is talking about?
No, I don't believe that, and I'm going to tell you why. Because, you know, again, I'm the biblical contextualist, so I look at the next verse, which plays along with what he just said in verse 19, which is, let his own eyes see his ruin and let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty.
See his own ruin. So what I've got is, let his eyes see his destruction and let him drink the wrath of the Almighty.
Right.
How does that play one against the other?
Because he's basically saying to these guys, you're telling me, okay, you just made these speeches in 15, you said build that in 18, I'm saying so far in 20, that each one of them made a reference to how the wicked is recompensed. And they also said that the wicked are recompensed by, even if they go down to Sheol in tranquility, their children will not. Their children will suffer. And he's saying, I don't see that. I'm not seeing that. He just went through this whole thing of saying, you know, his children go forth like flocks, that they lift up their voices and sing and dance, you know, like timbrels and flutes. So where is this, you know, where is this suffering that you're saying comes upon the children? You're saying that God hides disaster for sons, and I'm saying, forget it. Let him be repaid that he may know it, not his children. And then he says, let his own eyes see his ruin and let him drink the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he delight in his house after him when a number of his months is to be at an end or to cut off? In other words, what he's saying is, why would the wicked care about the house he leaves behind when he's lived out his allotted months in peace? If he's wicked, who cares? You think he cares about his kids? So for me, this whole section of 19 through, you know, 22 is answering that argument.
So that's interesting, because that's
for me.
In the cross references, it does cross reference from Job 21:19 to Exodus 20 verse 5. However, Ira, in the study notes, there are also some cross-references. And in the study notes, it says, Job denies the dogma that even if a wicked person prospers temporarily, his children will be punished. Job's position is sustained by other passages in the Bible. See Deuteronomy 24:16. For once, if we go over to Deuteronomy 24:16, and this is what it says. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin.
Amen. And okay. Ezekiel 18.
And Ezekiel chapter 18, it of course, goes there.
So why did you take me on this segue when we could have just...
because I mean, we got to nut this out. I mean,
still carrying Christian baggage around?
It's a little bit, the way that it's worded in Job is a little bit, it's a little bit cloudy.
But it's Job. I mean, come on. What, are you kidding me?
So in a nutshell, Ira, you know, in just a
this
quick
is
nutshell.
Job. So in other words, because it doesn't say, because it doesn't have for you a clear indication, you're not going to take the context of the surrounding verses.
Of course we have
and,
to take
and the two arguments and the two or three arguments that have come before this, where each one of those men are saying, look, the wicked will, if they don't suffer now, their children will suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And when this... we, just before we get up to this verse, what does he say? Do I need to read it to you again?
Go on.
I will.
Go on.
Let me go up. They send forth like a flock their little ones, and their children dance. They take or lift their voices up like the timbrel and harp and rejoice to the voice of the flute.
Mm-hmm.
They wear out their days in the good, and in a moment they descend to Sheol. So this is talking about the children after their ox, you know, impregnates and doesn't fail.
There it is.
Then they say to God, turn aside from us in the knowledge of your ways, we will not delight, so forth and so on. Behold, their goodness is not in hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. This is the and then I refer to that. Then it's tell me. You know, now he's talking to them. He goes, you know, how seldom is the lamp of the wicked put out, and his calamity come upon it? Does he divide destruction in his anger? Meaning, is God giving them their recompense? Let them be like straw. Now he's saying what should happen to them. Let them be like straw before the wind, and like chaff which is stolen by a storm. And then we get to this point. He says, this is what's happened to the children. You said something else. This is what I see happening to the children. And yet they say, we don't care about God. We don't need to hear about that. And he says, this is what should happen to them. And then we come to this verse that says, and I'm just translating it as it says, Eloha yitzpon levanav ono yishalem elav v'yeda. Eloha hides disaster to his sons. Let it be complete to him so that he may know. And complete because it's Yishalem, but Yishalem could mean to repay him. So let him repay him so that he may know. So basically, I can't see this as being anything else that he's saying to them, here, you guys say this, but I don't see it that way. They shouldn't be, because God has already said that in Deuteronomy 24. That says that God clearly says that he doesn't recompense the, you know, the father for the iniquity of the son, or the son for the iniquity of the father. And Ezekiel 18 talks about that as well. So,
which goes into much greater detail, and there's some more homework for the listeners. And
yeah, and then of course, like I said, the next two verses, let his eye see his ruin, and let him drink the wrath of the Almighty. He's saying, don't forget about the kids. For what does he delight in the house after him? Meaning, you know, what does he delight in his in what he's built up after he's gone, when he's already lived out his number of days and gone down in tranquility.
And so it goes on to say in Ezekiel 18, after, you know, God says, what do you mean by this proverb? Is he says in verse 3, as I live, says the Lord God, you shall no longer use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine, the soul of the father as well as the soul of the son is mine, and the soul who sins shall die.
You know, the question is being asked by Israel, why are we suffering for what our fathers have done? And God is basically telling them in that chapter, why would you say that? You can't say that to me anymore. I don't want to hear that anymore. You're not suffering for what they did. You're suffering for what you've done.
Fair enough. And that is the point. No, you're right. And that is the point. Yeah. And it goes on to say, he shall not, if he has sinned, he shall not live. If he has done any of the abominations, he shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him. However, if he begets a son who sees all the sins which his father has done and considers but does not do likewise, and it goes on to say the things that he doesn't do that his father did do, he shall not die for the iniquity of the father. He shall surely live. So on and so forth. Ezekiel 18. Very important.
All right, verse 22.
Verse 22. Can anyone teach God knowledge? Since he judges those on high, one dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and secure. His pails are full of milk, and marrow of his bones are moist. Another man dies in the bitterness of his soul.
What you just said?
The marrow of his bones are moist. What do you mean?
What does that mean?
they're not dry. They're not, you know, brittle. They're not, he's healthy. What are you talking about?
Okay, I'm just asking.
Full of life. You don't think so? His pails are full of milk.
Okay.
Hmm.
Did you want to stop there? Or
well, we can stop there if you want. You wanted to stop there. What do you mean? Actually, no. What I've even got I've got an asterisk. What's this about?
You have an asterisk
in verse 24. I've got in verse. All right, no. I have to ask you. What do you got in Hebrew?
So let's look at verse 23. Verse 23 is really interesting. It says Ze Yamut Be'etzem Tumo. And read that for me, what yours said.
In 23, it says, one dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and secure.
Yeah. So I would think that would be a good translation of the second part of the verse. But the one who dies in full integrity, or however you said it, it's something very interesting there. That word, the second word, Ze Yamut Be'etzem, that word Be'etzem, it kind of caught me. So I did a little bit of research on that. And it's interesting that that also could be translated as shutting his eyes. Okay. Etzem, or the ayin sadi mem, just that root, can mean to shut the eyes. And actually, there's two verses where that same root is used. And that's Proverbs 16:30 that says, Otse enav la lachshov tapuchot koritz. He shuts his eyes to meditate on deception. He pinches his lips while completing his evil. Mm-hmm. And then Isaiah 33:15 has actually ve'otzem, which is also the ayin sadi mem there. And Isaiah 33:15 says, he who walks in righteousness speaks uprightly, rejects unjust gain from extortion, shakes his hand from holding a bribe, or mean waves his hand against the bribe, closes his ear against listening to blood, which, you know, closes there against listening to the shedding of blood, and shuts his eyes from looking at evil. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that that's a better translation, that it should actually read, this one dies shutting his eyes in his integrity, being holy and satisfied, especially in context of this idea of the death and everything that we see about going down to Sheol in tranquility. It just makes more sense to me.
So speaking of a better translation, verse 24, sure. I've got his pails are full of milk. What do you – pails? What have you got?
So that's a very interesting – this is also a very interesting verse, because the first word in the Hebrew is atinav. And atinav could be attributed to the Hebrew ma'atan, which is the vat where they would allow the olives to be collected to produce this very rich kind of oil. And sometimes atinav will also be related to the idea of breasts.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
So when it says atinav malu chalav, that it could be saying his breasts are filled with milk. Why? Because that word atinav, that fatness of the oil or the richness of the oil, could mean that it's kind of the fat milk of the breasts. And it's talking about the strength or the health that comes from that. So it could be translated a couple of different ways there.
So I guess if I had to choose one of those, I'm going to stick with pails because I don't want my breasts to be full of milk.
Yeah, but it's not talking about when it says his breasts are filled with milk. It's obviously talking about, you know, his wife. You know, it's not talking about, you know, his breasts. Come on, Joe. No.
Well, come on. You're the one who's telling you. I'm just saying, there's an asterisk there. That's all I'm saying. And the marrow of his points.
Wait a minute. What is your asterisk?
Okay, so I'm looking at the asterisk.
This shouldn't even be edited out. This is just too funny.
It's in the text.
I want to know what the asterisk is.
I go down to the asterisk. It says the Septuagint and Vulgate reads bowels. So his bowels are full of milk, as if to say, you know, he's well fed. He's you know, he's and his milk. He's full of calcium. Good man, which is why the marrow of his bones are moist. The Syriac reads sides, and the Targum reads breasts.
Right.
There it is.
Right. So that's why I told you that. And really, when it says, and the marrow of his bones is moist, it's actually that word, yishukeh, comes from the idea of to be watered. If we look at that root throughout the Tanakh, it's talking about being watered, even as like the garden was watered in Gan Eden. When it talks about it in Bereshit, it will use that root to be watered. And so it really means it has the connotation of watered or replenished. So yeah, it speaks to what you said, which is the vitality.
Not brittle, but strong, green, like a well-watered plant. Sure.
Right. And then this next verse now contrasts, because it says, you know, first in those two verses, we see the one that dies. And now in verse 25, it says, and this one that dies. So it gives you.
Yeah, I've got another man dies in the bitterness of soul, as opposed to closing his eyes in integrity, as you said, or as I've got in full strength. He dies in the bitterness of his soul, having never eaten with pleasure. And again, maybe we could make crossing over to milk, perhaps in his bowels, that he hasn't eaten in pleasure. And he lies down in the dust just the same way. And the worms.
No. Wait a minute. Go back. What did you just say? He? No.
Sorry. They together. Lie down Yachad. Together. They lie down alike in the dust.
Right. Yachad. Together. Yachad. They lie down in the dust. And what happens?
Oh, you know, the worms.
Worms cover them.
The maggots eat them.
Yeah. So basically, he's giving you the distinction between two people, and then he says, Yachad al apa yishkavu v'rima tichase alehem, that together they lie in the dust and worms cover them, meaning it doesn't matter. What he's saying is, here's that thing about the divine providence here. Look, he's saying about the one guy, oh, he's, you know, great. Everything's happening great for him. But this guy dies in the bitterness of his soul, never tasting goodness, never tasting happiness. And Job is basically saying, look, everything is happenstance. Nothing is connected with a person's actions. And he supports this by the next verse, where he says to them, what?
26?
In the next verse, he says...
It says, look, I know your thoughts and the schemes with which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the prince and where is the tent, the dwelling place of the wicked?
Yeah, right. But he says to them, I already know what you guys are planning. I already know what you're going to say, because you say the same old thing. And you're saying, where is the house of the nobleman and where is the tent, the dwelling place of the wicked? In other words, the righteous man has nothing to worry about, Job, because he can dwell in a tent and nothing will happen to him. But the wicked are the one who build themselves fortresses, because they're the ones that have something to worry about, which is kind of pretty funny considering that, you know, these things happened to him while his sons were in tents. You know, we're assuming they didn't really have fortresses.
True.
And this is why I love this next verse.
Have you not asked those who travel the road? And do you not know their signs?
Right. And it's interesting because, of course, like you said, that word signs, or, you know, from the Hebrew ot, which means signs, but it can also mean to agree. It doesn't necessarily have to always be a sign. And, of course, a sign has to do with agreeing with something that has already been said. That's why it can be translated in these two different ways. And when we see this word in the Hebrew, tikaneru, actually in this conjunction, it can be a false presentation or it can mean to inspect carefully. So what you really have here is something that would say, have you not asked the wayfarers or those that go on the road, as you said, and do you not inspect carefully their sign or their evidence? So in other words, you're seeing these men that go all about. You are supposedly wise men yourself, and you consult with other wise men that travel the world. They go from place to place traveling around. And yet these truths you refuse to mention. You don't talk about the truths that you learned from them. You just come up with your own your understanding. And so what Job does in these remaining verses is he acts as if he's going to tell them what they should really be saying and what really is the answer that a wise person should have, but what they have heard from the wayfarers as well.
And it says, for the wicked are reserved for the day of doom. They shall be brought out on the day of wrath. Who condemns his way to his face and who repays him for what he has done? Yet he shall be brought to the grave and a vigil kept over the tomb. The clods of the valley shall be sweet to him. Everyone shall follow him, as countless as have gone before him. How then can you comfort me with empty words, since falsehood remains in your answers?
Wow. So, you know, so here he's saying in these last, you know, verses that we see, in verse 30, I have for the to the day of calamity, the evil is spared. Mm-hmm. To the day of wrath, they will be carried. And then he goes into this idea of what's going to happen to them. He says, who will declare toward his face his way? Who will repay him for what he has done? Remember, I talked about that earlier, that he basically was saying earlier, and now this is the verse that supports that, that the wicked man would laugh in your face for the rebuke that you're bringing to me, mm-hmm. because he knows from experience that he has nothing to fear.
He's
because
well.
his ox doesn't fail, and his children dance in the streets and raise up their voices like flutes, and he's carried to the grave, and men watch over his tomb. In other words, when he dies, he's carried to the grave with respect, and the clods of the valley are sweet to him. His burial experience will be sweet because there's this large number of mourners wanting to show their final respects.
Mm-hmm.
How then will you vainly comfort me? How will you in futility comfort me? For your answers remain full of falsehood. And the interesting thing there is, as a verb, there's a verb comes from the root to be untrue, where it talks about this idea of falsehood that we see in that last word, which is ma'al,
mm-hmm.
The last word in Hebrew. And interestingly enough, it comes from the idea of falsehood because it relates to violating one's legal obligation. And I think that's awesome in the fact that we've been talking about from the very beginning this idea of the divine court and the fact that this whole thing is taking place, you know, within the presence of the divine council that was called before God.
Mm.
But as a noun, so that's in the verbal root. But as a noun, of course, it means disloyalty or infidelity or fraud. And when it's used, it's normally related to God. For instance, you would see this in Vayikra, in the book of Leviticus, as it relates to the sacrifices,
mm-hmm.
in Leviticus 4, 5, and 6, that this would be considered when you break one of the commandments that would require a sacrifice. You'll often see this idea of you acting with disloyalty or infidelity towards God. And only here does it have the connotation of fraud, though. So Joe basically finishes his speech, but now he answers the group. So in other words, I said at the beginning, it seemed like in the singular that he was speaking to them as individuals because each one of them brought this same kind of argument about the wicked, okay, so if they don't suffer, their children will. Mm-hmm. And he disputes that and refutes that. And so now it seems like in this very last verse that now he's speaking to them as a group and he tells them, I've demonstrated to you clearly that there is no divine providence and that your arguments are ridiculous, that if I repent, things would be different because it's just vanity and futility what you're speaking.
Fair enough. Before we close up, let me just take you back, though, just to verse 30, just mm-hmm. to be clear. For the wicked are reserved for the day of doom. They shall be brought out on the day of wrath. The day of doom and the day of wrath.
Mm-hmm.
What's Job's understanding, do you think? Because we've already established, Ira, we've already established that both the man whose days are full of strength, he dies, and the man who dies in the bitterness of his soul, they both experience the same thing. They both go down to Sheol, and it says they go down alike in the dust, and the worms cover them. So too would this wicked man also, when he dies. But Job makes reference to the day of doom and the day of wrath.
For to the day of calamity, he is spared. He is spared evil, actually. And then Leyom Avarot Yuvalu, it's interesting because it's really, you know, to the day of wraths. You know, because it seems to be in the plural, avarot, yuvalu, he will be carried.
Interesting. So in my
so like the JPS translates it like this: the JPS says, "For the evil man is spared on the day of calamity, on the day when wrath is led forth." So they're basically saying that it's not two separate times. It's talking about that that what he's saying is that the evil man will be spared on the day of calamity, on the day when wrath is led forth. Mm-hmm. That, in other words, they're the same thing. This is the day that wrath is coming and calamity, but they're going to be spared from that.
But he's going to be spared. Okay, and right. that makes more sense, does mm-hmm. it not? In the whole context of Job chapter.
Oh, sure, 10. Sure. You know, I sometimes translate sometimes word for word, and I forget to make those distinctions. But yeah, certainly within the context, we're not saying that that he's spared for one and carried to another. That's not what it says.
No. But it is interesting because in the New King James that I have, the Christian translation, it seems to imply that the wicked are reserved, they're set aside for the day of doom. They'll get theirs in the end. Don't you worry. On the day of judgment, that's going to be, even though they've led a fulfilling life, or so it would seem, and they've prospered, and they shall be brought out on the day of wrath, and boy, will they know it then. That's the implication there. But
that may be true as it relates to other passages in Scripture, but certainly not in this one.
That's right. So in the context of this one, as you said,
not within the context. Yeah,
as you said, in the context of this, the Jewish Bible certainly makes more sense, flows with the context. For the evil man is spared on the day of calamity, on the day when wrath is led forth.
We don't want to discuss eisegesis as it relates to this verse.
Okay? We don't want to. No, we don't. Just remind everyone what eisegesis is.
No, I don't want to say it.
Okay.
Do you really want me to?
Reading into the text that which is not there, and quite often the joke is
looking at the text and saying, "I see Jesus."
I see Jesus in the Old Testament, in the Tanakh. I see Jesus, which is often referred to as eisegesis. It's we see what we want to see. We make connections when we want to make connections, but it's not necessarily in the context. And it doesn't necessarily make sense. We want to read within the context. And I do think that in this case, verse 30 is probably best with the Jewish Bible as opposed to the New King James.
And just as a disclaimer, we're not making light of anybody's faith here. We certainly don't have a problem with anybody that believes what they want to believe, but you don't need to look at every verse and try and read something into it that's not there. That's what I think the listeners need to understand about what we're saying, that we're not making fun of anything
fun
in particular. Yeah.
But you got to admit it's funny. I mean, come on.
No, it is funny. There's no question. When I first thought that up, I thought it was very funny. And the funny thing is that I thought it up way before I entered into my present part of my journey. So, you know, people can't, you know, accuse me of anything. It's something that I found even funny before this. So,
I just want to say, now that we've finished Job chapter 21, it is worth just reiterating while we're talking about this, Ira, that when I was in the Christian church, in the tradition that I came from, I was constantly being told, if I asked a question, but you've got to read the Old Testament with New Testament eyes. And I think, what do you mean by that? And then I went to Bible college, and they would talk about eisegesis and exegesis. And I had a friend come to me one time, and she said to me, "It's really weird, those words." I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, eisegesis." And I said, "Yeah, eisegesis is reading into the text that which is not there, you know, based on a conclusion you want to come to, or your presupposition, whatever it may be, but you're reading into the text something that clearly is not there." And exegesis is deriving from the text that which it is saying, that which it's conveying in its context. Exegesis. She goes, "I know, but it sounds like eisegesis sounds like I see Jesus, and exegesis sounds like exit Jesus."
Wait a minute. I thought this up.
I reckon it occurs to a lot of people. And you know, I don't think, I'm going to say, this will get me into trouble, but I think that's a very, very safe principle to hold to when you are reading from the Tanakh. All too often, and it really bothers me, people will go to the Tanakh and go fishing and go cherry picking for things that they think they can connect to their presupposition. They end up with all sorts of bizarre and very fairly, I will say, expressions of eisegesis, because they see Jesus in the text. And And really what we should be doing is exegesis. We should be reading the Tanakh from the perspective that it was written, in the context when it was written. What did it mean to them at the time? I mean, you know, right. It's just fair to say, right? It's just fair to say.
Yeah, and certainly this is certainly because most of the listeners of this show are people who naturally have been led towards Torah. This would make more sense to them. And so let me give you a very Jewish perspective. A very Jewish perspective, for instance, is the difference between the weight that's placed on the concept of Messiah in Judaism as opposed to the weight of the concept of Messiah to the believing community. The Rambam, who's one of the most respected sages in Judaism, wrote in his work Hilchos Melachim on the Mishneh Torah. Hilchos Melachim means concerning the kings. He talked about this idea at the very end about Mashiach. And one of the things that he says is that, look, these understandings of Messiah have been discussed by our sages, and there really is no way of knowing what it actually means until those days happen. Mm-hmm. And it's not foundational to our faith. And I think this is awesome because he says it's not foundational to our faith because it leads neither to the awe or to the love of God. Mm-hmm. And so what people should be focusing on, even if you're a believer in Messiah, and I don't, when I say a believer in Messiah, for the people that are listening here, obviously I'm talking about those people who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, or they call him Yeshua is the Messiah. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But if you're following Torah, don't make that your focus. Make the focus of your relationship be with following the instructions of God.
Mm-hmm. And reading it within the context.
And reading it within the context.
Now, and I will add, I'll just add, after you do so, and I'll say to the listeners, I'm still getting a grasp on reading the Tanakh in the in a way that that I hope to understand it in the same way that they understood it when it was written, when it was read to them, when they read it, when they were the audience back in the day. Mm-hmm. That's what you want to understand. And once you've done that and you feel like you've got a good grasp on that, by all means go back and go fishing for what you want to support your theology or your particular faith or the way that you see things if you want to do that. But know the difference between eisegesis and exegesis and always seek to establish solid exegesis first before you go back and try and support something in addition to that. Is that
well, sure. Yeah, obviously, because look, in the concept of Pardes, Peshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod, we don't look at the Sod first. We don't look at, the Kabbalistic or the mystical interpretation of the scripture. We look at the Peshat. We look at the literal interpretation. What does it say? I mean, who is it being said to? What's the context? What's going on at the time? Who are the people? Where are they? There's all of these things that have to be taken into consideration. Mm. When one looks at it. So we always look at the Peshat first. There's no other way of looking at it.
Rule of thumb. There we go. Yep. Thank you, my friend. Ira Michelson, Torah teacher Ira Michelson. Treasures from the Tanakh is the program and also the Facebook page. You can go to Treasures from the Tanakh, like the page, engage with the information there. Do we want to mention the other
Facebook endeavor? Should we tell them about my new thing?
Yeah, your
right,
new
so
thing.
This is only my new thing. My new thing. It's not our new thing. It's my new thing. And look, this is only for those of you that are interested in sharpening your swords. Hopefully many people have already listened to the interview that I did with you, the hour and a half interview.
If that wasn't
that
challenging
talks about
enough,
my journey.
If that wasn't challenging enough and you want to be challenged even more.
If you want to be challenged even more, there's a new Facebook group called To Hell and Back. And the reason why it's called To Hell and Back is because growing up as an Orthodox Jewish young man, I used to be chased home from shul, from synagogue, on Shabbat, having rocks thrown at me, being told that I was going to die and burn in hell because I didn't believe in Jesus. And it seems like some of the same rock throwers are back and have consigned me back to the fires of hell. And so I thought I would give them an opportunity in a place, in a group where there could be civil debate, civil discussion on the proof text people want to bring related to why they believe that Yeshua or Jesus is the Messiah, and then deal with those people in that same group that would counter those arguments in a civil, without personal attacks and so forth. So it's called To Hell and Back. a counter-missionary response.
A counter-missionary response. You'll find that on Facebook as well if you're keen to be challenged.
But you got to have thick skin, too, if you're going to be there, because it's a very diverse group of people. There are some very passionate Orthodox Jewish people. There are conservatives. There's Reform. There's Messianics. There's Hebrew roots people. There's former Christians, former Messianics. There are atheists. There are theists. I'm trying to be very open and inclusive, but really it's not meant to be a place to attack each other. It's meant to strictly deal with the language and context of the Hebrew scripture as it relates to those proof texts that people look to for proving that Yeshua is the Messiah.
We like context. There it is. Yep. All right, my friend, but I'm glad that you're on this program.
I'm glad to be on here, and I want to thank you, Jonah, because you do an amazing job for people that are, you know, interested in truth, and you do it without really an agenda, which I think is awesome. And you're basically giving people what they want rather than what you want to give them.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate that. Truth2u.org, truth2letteru.org. Next week, we're going to be in Job chapter 22. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.